But we'll come and read.
This morning we'll be reading from Matthew chapter 14, verses 1 through 21. At that time, Herod the Tetrarch heard the news about Jesus and said to his servants, "This is John the Baptist. He has risen from the dead, and that is why miraculous powers are at work in him. For when Herod had John arrested, he bound him and put him in prison because of Herodias, the wife of his brother Philip. For John had been saying to him, 'It is not lawful for you to have her.' Although Herod wanted to put him to death, he feared the crowd because they regarded John as a prophet. But when Herod's birthday came, the daughter of Herodias danced before them and pleased Herod so much that he promised with an oath to give her whatever she asked. Having been prompted by her mother, she said, 'Give me here on a platter the head of John the Baptist.' Although he was grieved, the king commanded it to be given because of his oaths and because of his dinner guests. He sent and had John beheaded in the prison, and his head was brought on a platter and given to the girl, and she brought it to her mother. His disciples came and took away the body and buried it, and they went and reported to Jesus. Now when Jesus heard about John, he withdrew from there in a boat to a secluded place by himself. And when the people heard of this, they followed him on foot from the cities. When he went ashore, he saw a large crowd and felt compassion for them, and he healed their sick. When it was evening, the disciples came to him and said, 'This place is desolate, and the hour is already late. So send the crowds away, that they may go into the villages and buy food for themselves.' But Jesus said to them, 'They do not need to go away. You give them something to eat.' They said to him, 'We have here only 5 loaves and 2 fish. And he said, 'Bring them here to me.' Ordering the people to sit down on the grass, he took the 5 loaves and 2 fish, and looking up toward heaven, he blessed the food, and breaking the loaves, he gave them to the disciples, and the disciples gave them to the crowds, and they all ate and were satisfied. They picked up what was left over of the broken pieces, 12 full baskets. Then there were 5,000 men who ate, besides women and children."
Thank you, Mike. That's exciting, isn't it? Humbled. Remember, I feel like I need to introduce myself. You guys know that Adam has been preaching through the month of June, and I typically take a break, and I am so thankful for Adam. I think that if you guys got the chance to hear Adam, if you didn't, I go back and listen to his series on Proverbs. It is such a joy to hear from Adam and preach the way that he does, and the manner in that I hope that you come to realize just the privilege that we have to have Adam on staff here at Reliance. He could fill any pulpit here in this city, across this nation, and he has chosen to serve alongside of us here. And it's a joy to serve with you, Adam, and I'm thankful very much for you. I don't know if I've ever told you this, and, you know, Adam, he never heard me preach when he said he was going to come here to Tri-Cities. He never had been here. As he drove out of the parking lot of DTS with his family and all of his stuff in the Ryder truck, I remember looking and thinking, we just stole DTS best. I think I actually said it to Dave. There it goes. We just stole it. And I don't know if he knew that. And if we could keep that a secret, that'd be wonderful. It was a joy. Not only it's a privilege to work alongside of Adam and to serve along with many of you in this community, I'm excited. Well, several of the reasons I'm excited, and I'm always excited about the ministry here at Reliance, is as I look at our eldership and the team that we have there and the men I get to look serve alongside, it's exciting. I get excited when I look at the staff, the ministry leads, the community leaders. I mean, we're everywhere. We're not a large church, but we're everywhere, whether it be working with refugees, Young Life, U Medical, building quilts for young moms, whether we're involved in mere ministries or foster care or fatherhood initiative, reaching in the community. We're everywhere, locally. And then internationally, we're beginning to put our fingers, whether it be in Russia or in Catania, the missionaries that we are beginning to support. And that is a large of the response of the generosity. And on top of all of that, we bought a building. You know, God did. And I think that we have much reason to celebrate, even though we're 5.5 years old. I mean, that in itself is God doing work at a pace that me and Adam and the elders could barely keep up with. But really what gets me excited is that Reliance still remains, after 5.5 years, committed to convictional preaching of God's word, the joyful delight of integrating our lives together and celebrating those who work in the image of Christ in our local communities and internationally. Because it is about eternity. Because what more than anything I'm excited about is that this community is fixated on learning what it means to keep our eyes fixed on Christ, and for others to enjoy seeing the privilege of knowing that to be true. And so with all of that said, with my break over, I'm excited that we're back in Matthew chapter 14. I'm excited that we're going back to Matthew. And why I'm really excited about Matthew chapter 14 is what Matthew does that presents before the reader an idea which we have all should be very familiar with. Two kings, two feasts, two responses. And one of the reasons why I get find this passage that I get to go to with joy is because I think we got it. But what I want to do today is raise that up a little bit more. And Matthew is creative in the way that he has written his gospel presentation. He could have put these stories in anywhere he wanted, but he put them here for a particular reason. He waits 14 chapters to pit two kings against themselves. And at the end, I hope this morning of celebration that we can leave knowing with great excitement which king we actually are fixated on to follow. Because he is no petty, low-ranking king which finds himself dependent upon systems, resources, power, or people to keep his position. Jesus Christ is king. And he pits him against Herod the Tetrarch. I love this. Maybe this will be a 2-hour sermon because it's been 5 weeks, right? No, it won't. I love it. But what I want to do is separate this into three parts. Two kings, then do some observation. Point two will be, let's look at the two different feasts. And then three, let's look at their responses, their two kings' responses. And the way that Matthew opens up chapter 14, verse 1 is interesting. Look with me as he talks and he pits these two kings against themselves. At that time, Herod the Tetrarch. At this point, we with being a Gentile mind or ancient, more recent times, this is hard to understand what a tetrarch is, but really what it is a king who has, well, he's a quarter of a king. He's less of kings. He is a petty king, is what the translations actually give him. He is the petty king. And so up to this point, Matthew has waited. He's waited. He's talked about some kings. He's mentioned them. He's hinted at them. But this, all of a sudden, he says, I want you to see this king. And I'm going to pick Jesus Christ, the true king, against him. And let's see who has the better results. And that way, stir our affections to even know who more Christ is. And here, Herod the king, the petty king. And to be a tetrarch, you have to be appointed. It's one that is appointed by Rome to oversee this small region. So if you were to gather with the kings in Rome, you would have gotten a seat at the table. You would have been tiered down on the bottom of the list, and you wouldn't have been highly respected. But Herod here is now finding conflict with this one king that's wandering around in his territory. And he's been appointed not by the kings of Rome. Man, chapter 1 of Matthew, the work that the writer has made. He said, this king hasn't been appointed by the greatest rulers of the world. No, this king has been appointed by the God which has created all the heavens. In the very introduction, you have the Father by the Spirit giving birth to this king. Early on in his ministry, at this baptism, the Father rolls back the heavens merely so that he can tell those who are around, this is the one whom I am well pleased. And so I love what Matthew is doing here. Small petty king appointed by Rome. true everlasting king appointed by God, who is God himself. You got to love what Matthew does here. He pits these two together, and by the end, you hope your affections are stirred to more. I know who's my king and who I ought to enjoy and who I ought to trust in. Not only this, they're appointed. They're both appointed, but they both have received some type of confrontation. The confrontation that Jesus has experienced in his ministry as king, appointing his kingdom upon earth, has been this. Nobody believes him. Pharisees don't believe him. The Sadducees don't believe him. I shouldn't say nobody believed. The only people that believe him are the 12 and the crowds who are wandering and following him and are amazed with him. But the religious leadership, they don't, cannot fathom that he is in fact the Son of Man who can forgive sins. And they reject him. His own hometown rejects him. So Jesus in his ministry finds himself finding some confrontation. So how is he going to respond to it? Herod, the tetrarch, the petty, low, peasant-pleasing king, he is the one who has also faced some confrontation. Let's read what he has faced. Let's look at verse 2. Verse 1, I'll start 1. At that time, Herod the tetrarch heard the news about Jesus and said to his servants, "This is John the Baptist. He has risen from the dead. That is why miraculous powers are at work in him." He just totally discredits that, in fact, Jesus, who he is, who he says he is, and gives it to somebody else. Well, who's John the Baptist? Well, as the reader, we recognize he is the one who has been proclaiming the future Messiah to come, who has pointed out that he who comes after him is of greater worth and significance. It was Christ. John the Baptist in verse 3 kind of poked his thorn at Herod in the past. Well, for when in verse 3, when Herod had John arrested, he bound him and put him in prison because of Herodias, the wife of his brother Philip. For John had been saying to him, "It is not lawful for you to have her." Although Herod wanted to put him to death, he feared the crowd because they regarded John as a prophet. Up to this point, Herod the tetrarch, what he ended up doing is this. He saw his brother's wife, liked her, courted her in some secretive way, and the two of them thought to themselves, "I'll leave my spouse if you leave your spouse, and we'll get married openly in public." John the Baptist, watching this play out, was the voice in which said, "Herod, that's wrong." And in order to silence that which was convicting him of his wrong, what does he do? Well, we'll lock him up. But not only did he want to lock him up, he wanted to get rid of his voice entirely. This is how he handles confrontation. And while he is trying to get rid of him entirely, he doesn't, because he's afraid of the people. Herod the tetrarch faces, he's appointed king who faces some conflict, and he handles things by locking up people and yet still trying to navigate how to respond to the people he's over in charge. Jesus himself, up to this point, 14 chapters of confrontation, how does he respond? Unchanged, unmoving, consistently the same, unconcerned by how the people might interpret him. Times he preaches, he teaches, he heals, he confronts, and he always remains the same. While they are faced with different conflicts or confrontation, they were both appointed by one by Rome, one by God the Father. We ultimately want to find what is their response ultimately. And so here we go. Two kings, two appointed. Now let's look at their feasts. Matthew's doing something. He's presenting a king of the world to us to see, and then the king of the one who is over the heavens, who has now incarnated himself among us. And now we ought to say, who ought to be our king? And here the kings have their feasts. The first one, Herod the tetrarch, look at his feast. What's going on? Verse 6. But when Herod's birthday came, the daughter of Herodias danced before them and pleased Herod. What? Why is he having a feast? Well, it's his birthday. And it's because it's his birthday, he's invited all the significant guests within his kingdom. We're talking, Mark records that it's his military advisors, it's his governors, it's all the people of significant importance are at his birthday party. If you're somebody, you're there, right? And in the meantime, during the party, the daughter of his wife, or an inappropriate wife, danced before them, and it pleased Herod. Having been prompted by her mother couldn't stand John the Baptist. She didn't like him either. Could imagine nagging she probably had toward, aren't you? You got him locked up. Why did you just end it and kill him? She waits, she waits, she waits. And all of a sudden, sees the opportunity. Verse 7. After her dance, he promised with an oath to give her whatever she asked. And having been prompted by her mother, she said, give me here on a platter, the head of John the Baptist. And look how he responds. Although he was grieved, the king commanded it because he had given of his oath and because of those who were reclining with him, his dinner guests. Fascinating. One feast is produced by a birthday party, and in the midst of this, he is going to kill someone, which is just adding to his immorality. But why? Why? Fear. Fear of those who are at his dinner table. What is Matthew trying to teach us here as he pits two kings against themselves? One, the kings of this world are not actually kings. If they are manipulated like reeds in the wind of their peasants or military influence or resources, they are actually slaves. Interesting. And we wouldn't disagree with this, even in our political system. How is it that, I'm not supposed to get political, backtrack. How is it that you can have a politician once hold to one view, then all of a sudden, years later, change their view? Now, in some sense, in humanity, we ought to be able to change our opinions. But some of these opinions are immoral at best. They are significant, and then you can have this sliding change. Why does that happen? To please people. In order to gain the position that they love and desire. Herod the Tetrarch, this petty king, is exactly stuck. He wants to kill John the Baptist, but he doesn't. Why? Because of the fear for the people. But now he's at a dinner table, gave a promise, and he is going to kill John the Baptist. Why? Because of the fear of the people. He's not a king. Matthew pits two kings. One of them's not. And as the reader, we have to recognize something that the world's best leaders within the world, historically ever, are actually kings. I mean, he's got all the royal resources, all the best guests, and look where the other king is sitting. He has no celebration, nothing. Rather, he receives word that John the Baptist, the one that has been the greatest contribution to his ministry for announcing it, has been taken off the list. Voice taken away. Gone. Look what happens to him. Verse 13. Now when Jesus heard this about John, he withdrew. Well, why? Well, one, he's probably mourning. I could see that as significant. But two, there's a greater reason here, I think. The word here with through has been used repetitively up to this point throughout Matthew. Anytime Jesus comes up, whether it be the religious system or the political powers that ought to be in his area, when this word pops up, and Herod the Great, the father of Herod the Tetrarch, wants to kill Jesus when he's a child. Angel came to Joseph and said, withdraw to Egypt. And so he picks up his family and they withdrew. Joseph, after hearing that Herod the Great died, he moves back to Galilee. And upon hearing that the son of Herod the Great was now ruler of that area, again he withdrew. The first time that John the Baptist gets arrested, he withdrew. So he is probably mourning, but he's also withdrawing for safety as well. And look what happens. Who comes following? No party. No invitation. Fleeing. Withdrawing. Mourning. And look where he sits. Verse 13. While Jesus heard about John, he withdrew from there in a boat. No palaces. Matthew is not mincing words. He picked these words to a secluded place by himself. And when the people heard of this, and his popularity has gained so much momentum, they followed him on foot from the cities. So that when he went ashore, he saw the large crowd and felt compassion for them and healed their sick. Herod the Tetrarch lives and he rules in fear. The true king, the manner in which he is going to have his feast, no invitation, no event, no reason to celebrate, really. And yet the crowds have followed him on foot to be where he's at in a secluded or desolate place. Who's worth following as king? That's what Matthew's doing here. Why? Two kings, two feasts. Herod has all the resources to have his feast. Jesus, resources. He has no resources. In fact, the disciples, look what happens here at his feast. First, oh man, the disciples, they're coming to realize who he is too. Verse 15, when it was evening, the disciples came to him and they said, this place is desolate. We didn't invite him, Jesus. This place is desolate. They've all come and the hour's late. Already late. So send the crowds away that they may go into the village and buy food for themselves. Their intentions are noble. Absolutely noble. Jesus' response. I would highlight it. I would box it. I would write it on my mirror. But Jesus said to them, they do not need to go away. Why? Because he's king. He's the one who spoke in the universe into being. He's the one that created them. He's the one that could offer life. And he says then to them, verse 16, they do not need to go. Where else are you going to send them? To the cities? Herod the Tetrarch? You give them something to eat. No, that at that point, now then, I one of the disciples' response in one of the other gospels, I believe it's John, upon this request from Jesus, you feed them. They said, well, that would take like 200 denarii, which is like 8 months' pay. And that would just give people crumbs. Literally what the disciples were saying, you want us to feed them? You'd have to be a king to feed them. There's no way. The cities, for some sense, it's kind of funny because the disciples are telling them to go down to the city, and the city's not going to have enough food for 10 to 12,000 people. I love this passage. What the writer's doing. Look at your earthly kings, those petty, pleasing, peasant, dependent kings. And you get this king put out in the worst scenario in the secluded, desolate place with no resources. Look what he does. You give them something to eat. Verse 17. They said to him, "Well, all we have, 5 loaves, 2 fish, and you have to know this story. I've heard it 100 times, so it's here first for the first time. 5 loaves, 2 fish. We got nothing." Realistically, what they had was enough for the 12 disciples and Jesus. That's all they got. That's all they got. And then the king takes his position. You've got to notice the tempo of what happens then. And he said to them, "Bring them. Kings, king, bring them to me." Notice verse 19. Ordering the people to sit down. He's seen the crowds. He has compassion over them. He sees their sickness. He heals them. And yet he is a king in which if he goes into a secluded place, he goes into a desolate place, those who have seen him were willing to walk around the edges of the lake to get to him. Herod the Tetrarch. He just rules in the way that which he hopes he makes the people happy. This king, unmoved, unwavering, compassionate, causes everyone to want to pursue him and ordering them. Man, I wish the translation here was just a little different. But it's the word here, he orders the people to sit down. The word there, recline at a banquet. Herod the Tetrarch, he was afraid of his guests as they reclined at his table. But this king, where does he tell them to recline? On the earth. That which he created. Recline at my table. The grass. And they sit. And look at the order he takes. He took the 5 loaves, the 2 fish, looking up towards the heavens. He blessed the food, breaking the loaves. He gave them to the disciples, and the disciples gave them to the crowds. And they all ate. And I'd underline it. I'd circle it. And I would write it on our mirrors. And were satisfied. How long has our world been looking for a king that they could be satisfied in? We know it even as a country. When a president gets elected, where matter where you stand, one might be hopeful, the other one is mourning. No one's satisfied. Even in our country today, no one's satisfied with the leadership and their ability to answer the spiritual needs and the physical needs. This world produce some significant leaders, but never of this quality. Could feed. They picked up the baskets, verse 20, that were left over, and there were 12 full baskets left over. All satisfied, and there was prosperity. I love this text. I love this passage because what it ought to do for us as the reader, one, to recognize that the leadership that the world produces, to have reasonable expectations for them. They're motivated for the love of people, even if they have the greatest resources. It's a matter of time before they're taken down. I actually feel sorry for Herod. He has to rule a kingdom in which has to please everyone, not only the people he's ruling in, but not only the generals and governors that he's ruling with, but also Rome. I mean, that's a full-time job. And then think about our House of Representatives and our senators and our president. That, nobody wakes up in the morning, unless you're insane, no, I shouldn't say that, to run for those positions. Why? Why would you do that? Because you have to be willing to bend like the reed of the winds of society when they call upon it. not this king. How is it that Jesus does not have to bend? How is it? Because he's king. The world produces those who become king. He is king. Jesus doesn't take a poll. Jesus doesn't take a tour to raise support. No, he takes a tour to call those to repentance to be a part of his kingdom. He doesn't run for office. He is the office. He doesn't acquire power. He rather, because he may has it, gives it up humbly and willfully. He's of a totally different category. Herod the Tetrarch has to kill to keep his position. Christ can be killed and still have his position. What's fascinating about the feeding of the 5,000 is the words that he uses in verse 19. And this is why I'm excited about Reliance Fellowship. As we continue to walk in and into this community and within the society and allow God to use us as we fix our eyes on Christ, is what he says in verse 19. Notice the order. Ordering the people to sit down on the grass, he took the 5 loaves of fish, and looking up towards the heavens, he blessed the food. Breaking the loaves, he gave them to the disciples, and the disciples gave them to the crowds. The word order is distinct for a reason. Because on the night of his greatest offering, before he went on to the cross, the same order shows up again. But this time, it's not being offered to a crowd. It's being offered to the world. And it's himself. And if you remember, Matthew 26, 26, Jesus took some bread. And after blessing it, he broke it. And he gave it to the disciples. And we're going to be finishing the Gospel of Matthew as we keep our eyes fixed on the greatest hope of the world, in that Christ has given all the world hope if they would fix their eyes on him. Not, I hope I don't sound degrading, but when you compare the kings of this world to Christ, they're petty, low-ranking, peasant-pleasing kings. That's what Matthew is trying to say. We ought to pray for them. Oh man, they need our prayers and respect them, indeed. But they are completely dependent upon resources, popularity, success, power, in order to keep those positions. Not our King, who is Christ, who can take 5 loaves, 2 fish, and feed thousands, or give himself and provide hope to the world. And that's what I'm excited about. I remember as elders, we were sitting down thinking about buying this building. We've asked all along the way, where do you want us? Where do you want us? And I'll be honest with you too. In January, when we made the presentation that we needed to raise the funds for this, we didn't have any idea how much we had to raise up in support. And that was a step of faith for me. Because I'm told, don't launch campaigns where you fail. Because otherwise that can develop a culture of failure. We ought not to walk in fear, but dependence. And I know that Reliance, if God would have said no, we would not have felt defeated. We would have been joyful that we didn't go somewhere where he didn't want us to be. But that's not how he spoke, has he? He just says he wants us here. He wants us here. He wants us here continuing to reach out to our neighbors, families, friends, those within our school, showing the incredible worth of our Son, or our Savior Jesus Christ, who can satisfy their spiritual need and their physical needs and have left over. The kings of the world cannot even compete with him. And he did it in a secluded place. I don't know where you're at. I do not know if you do not know who this king is. But I would encourage you, if you would just spend the time even reading the Gospel of Matthew, you will be amazed at his incredible worth and what he is providing you if you would receive him. Which requires, and this is what Matthew has been saying all along, to repent and make Christ Lord of your life, King. Not a peasant-pleasing king. And so when God says, you must go here, we walk. And we obey. When he calls us to forgive, we forgive. When he calls us to give, we give. And you guys have been generous. I pray, this last month, we were able to baptize 4 people. And more already signed up for September. That would be something that God would always produce in prosperity, and that he would not stop saving people for eternity. Would you pray with me? Lord, it is easy indeed to fix our eyes on